This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the days after September the 11th, Americans began asking questions that still haunt U.S. intelligence officials. Why didn't we do a better job tracking down Osama bin Laden? Did we know there were terrorists among us? Why didn't we stop them? Those insistent questions led to the creation of the 9/11 Commission, which issued its report a year ago. Now there's new information about an elite Army intelligence unit codenamed Able Danger that linked Mohammed Atta and other 9/11 hijackers to an al-Qaeda cell in New York before the attacks, charges that meetings were set up to pass that intelligence on to the FBI, and that those meetings were then blocked by military lawyers. In a moment, we'll talk with a 22-year veteran of the group that had oversight of the Able Danger Unit. Then we'll hear from Thomas Kane, the chairman of the 9/11 Commission. Later in the program, competitive computer worms and the hole in Windows 2000, and the fossil hunters who hit the mother lode in Central Oregon. But first, if you want to know more about the intelligence walls that existed before 9/11 or about the data mining that came up with these links among terrorists, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now is Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, who was formerly chief of Task Force Stratus Ivy, which supported the Able Danger Intelligence Unit. He's with us by phone from Washington. Colonel Schaefer, good of you to be with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being on.
First of all, explain what Able Danger was and your role with it.
Essentially, Able Danger was a global targeting effort to look at all aspects of al-Qaeda as an organization. And as you can probably imagine, it's a very daunting task. It's not something easily done. We knew back in the late 90s that this was a growing threat, and because of that, the Chairman of Joint Chiefs, General Hugh Shelton, had tasked Special Operations Command to essentially look at how we could conduct operations when on order to begin trying to essentially understand the nature of al-Qaeda, how it functions, what it does, and then be able on call, and that is to say when it's determined by leadership, to do something to counter the operations, to stop them from being able to do attacks.
Mm-hmm. And the systems that were used, now I understand you're not an intelligence analyst, but the systems they were used were data mining, or one of the systems.
One of the key systems which we're talking about in this case, and again, let me be clear on this, there are a number of aspects of Able Danger which are still highly classified we obviously won't get into. But the one issue we've talked about here is the fact that, yes, data mining and using about, by the estimate of the doctor who put it all together, 2.5 terabytes of information, all what we consider open source, and I'll define it by saying open source, not classified government computers, in which the using smart algorithms looking for patterns within that amorphous data. And then pulling those patterns out and trying to have intelligence analysts make their best judgment as to certify or decertify the linkages established by those algorithms.
And this linkage analysis, you say, identified Mohammed Atta and three of the other 9/11 hijackers with a al-Qaeda cell in Brooklyn.
That's correct. And this is one of the key issues regarding some of the bantering going on right now. The Able Danger was not about locations and times. It was about linkages and associations. It was about what we saw in the data that showed these guys had traits similar to other guys who had conducted terrorist operations in the past. And then because of where the communications were going and what was going on regarding, again, this open source data, that algorithm, the series of algorithms, kind of clumped them together in a cluster in Brooklyn.
Now, this information, the unit wanted to pass on to the FBI.
That's correct. That's where I also came into the picture again, because the internal officers, again, I'm a supporting organization helping them do their job.
Mm-hmm.
Internally, there was a debate about what to do about the individuals who were considered U.S. persons. Now, U.S. persons defined back in that era as anyone who essentially was here legally, who had the same rights and privileges as someone like you or me.
Mm-hmm.
And that restriction basically gives you the right to the privacy. You're not going to be, you know, scrutinized or have things happen to you that shouldn't. In this case, without, I think, due cause, these individuals were given the same basic rights and privileges as us, and therefore the lawyers at the time said, for the folks, keep in mind we got a lot of different hits on these on
sure.
terrorists, not just these guys there. But for the guys here in the United States that were located, you know, somehow associated or located in the United States, we'd have to leave those alone, pretend they don't exist.
because of fears that, well, as far as anybody knew, they were in the country legally, and,
yes.
and they were protected.
That's correct. That was the thinking of the time by the lawyers, yes.
Okay. Now, well, obviously, things move on. 9/11 happens.
Right.
You were then approached sometime afterwards by the 9/11 Commission. You were by that time in Afghanistan.
That's correct. I was at the time that the 9/11 Commission, Mr. Dillikow and company, came to visit. I was there as the operations chief of...
He was the executive staff director.
Right, executive staff director. He came with two staffers and a executive branch lawyer. And when they visited there, I was there working as the operations officer for Defense Humint there on the ground at Bagram. And the command did a data call saying, hey, does anyone have information that may be relevant to the pre-9/11 era regarding counterterrorism? And, of course, I volunteered through the chain of command, the commanding general, and said, I have this information. He said, and he validated. He said, yes, I think you should talk to the commissioners, or the staffers, I should say.
Right.
And at that point in time, I put together a two-page talking point paper in which I laid out all the different issues which you've now seen kind of swirling around the news regarding Able Danger. Obviously, there's some other things that are more classified. I'm not talking to anyone about regarding this in the news, but we're talking about essentially the open source data mining and the methodology used using the, and I might add this, the Army's land information warfare activity. It was really their technology and their location which actually produced this outcome regarding the Brooklyn cell.
As you know, the 9/11 Commission has said, look, we've gone through the notes that our staff members took at that interview in Afghanistan. We didn't hear the name Mohammed Atta.
Well, I don't know what exactly they heard, because I've read their 12 August response to my comments, and they attribute things to me which I never said, like something about me complaining about the Congress and the Permanent House Select Committee on Intelligence. I never said anything about the Permanent House Select Committee on Intelligence, not even my notes. And nor did I say that the Able Danger was focused, and it's right here in a paragraph, that I provide one man recounting information about al-Qaeda activities in Afghanistan before 9/11 referred to a DOD program known as Able Danger. Well, I didn't do that. I simply talked about Able Danger being a global targeting program of al-Qaeda. So this concerns me that this paragraph here describing their meeting with me can be so far off by the fact that, you know, I had by bullets what I talked to them about. And the bottom bullet, after I talked about the technology and who was all involved, was... we found, you know, two of the three cells which conducted 9/11 to include Atta. Now, I don't know if it was so low-key they didn't recognize it, but I can tell you, at the time I said what I did, there was a great deal of interest. People perked up, and I talked for about an hour and 15 minutes. And in addition to that, after we got done with the discussion, I was asked by Mr. Zelikow himself to continue to recontact the commission upon the completion of my tour to Afghanistan when I returned to Washington. Gave me his card. One of his other staffers gave me his card and then asked me to please contact them when I got back.
Mr. Zelikow, we've been unable to reach him because he works at the State Department. We've left messages. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Tom Kaine, who's was the chairman of the 9/11 Commission. And I do need to ask you, there are differing accounts of what you told them and about what its significance is.
Right. Well, the significance of it to me is that they were very interested in the beginning. Apparently, that it did. You know, if you're the individual, the staff individual looking at Al Qaeda and all the aspects of what led to the attack, I would think learning of a program which talked about Al Qaeda a year in advance of the attack would be of significance. And I would cite to you their own, again, 12 August response, where they talk about after the meeting, the commission staff promptly prepared a memo, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
And then still in Afghanistan, Dr. Zelikow called back to the commission headquarters in Washington, requested the information about Able Danger. So something prompted him to take immediate action. So, I don't know what exactly the recollection is. I haven't talked to them, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But my recollection is, you know, obviously I said something which responded, had them give an instant response to try to get the information.
Mm-hmm.
And again, following up, coming back and talking to him and offering up a full set of the Able Danger documents, which I had with my possession, within my office.
And finally, Colonel Schaefer.
Yes.
It's now almost 4 years after 9/11.
Right.
Why is this coming out now?
Excellent question. And I want this to be very clear. Congressman Walden was approached by the DOD. I've been working with the Navy to resurrect a certain aspect of the Able Danger capability, specifically the data mining capability. Navy is interested in trying to recreate some of those capabilities to do the data mining, massive parallel processing, et cetera, et cetera. as part of that process, one of the things I was sent over to do is request money, to informally talk to the congressman about getting money for the project.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during these discussions talking about how we're going to do the project, he started questioning both the Navy officer and myself about, well, what happened to the original project? And that's where it came up about the fact that we did talk to the 9/11 Commission about this stuff, and we figured everybody knew about it. Then Congressman Willen started doing investigations, and I must say, my hat's off to him. He actually was the one who kind of uncovered all this stuff. He found out that the commission had not been briefed, and that apparently there was no real mention made of Al-Qaeda. I mean, of Able Danger in the final report.
Mm-hmm.
That I think was troubling to him, and I think that's why we're here where we're at now, because he did his speech on the floor of the House, and that was already obviously picked up. Sir, my objective here is to recreate and ensure we have capabilities which will help us to prevent the next 9/11. That is the only reason I'm doing this.
Capabilities like Able Danger.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, for whatever reason, this has become a major issue. Believe me, sir, after today, I had no desire to go down this path. I mean, it is exhausting. But it has to be done, in my view, because I think information has to get out, and I think we have to account for why some of these things weren't looked at as part of the overall report.
Colonel Schaefer, thank you very much for being with us today. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer was associated with the Army's Able Danger Intelligence Unit, and he joined us by phone here in Washington. With us on the phone now is former governor of New Jersey and the former chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Kane. It's good of you to be with us.
Hey, thank you. It's good to be with you.
We just have a few seconds before we get to the break. I'm hoping you can stay with us over that, but I know you've been listening to at least the last few seconds of what Colonel Schaefer had to say. What's your response?
Well, I haven't got any response. I mean, I don't. I obviously don't know Colonel Schaefer. Wasn't in any meeting with Colonel Schaefer. Don't know any of the information he's talking about, and none of the information he's talking about was presented to the commission.
None of it was.
No. What we do have is a meeting which he refers to
in Afghanistan,
which was held in Afghanistan. There were four people there beside Colonel Schaefer, three from our staff, one from the White House. The question, Able Danger, was brought up. Our staff none of them heard the name Muhammad Atta, or they would have reacted.
Governor Kane, I'm going to have to ask you to pause right there. We'll get back to this right after the break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Able Danger is the name given to the Army Intelligence Group that was blocked from sharing information with the FBI well ahead of the 9/11 terror attacks on Muhammad Atta and other future 9/11 attackers. That's according to Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, who we heard from just a few moments ago. You're invited to join our discussion with questions about what was known and when and how information was transferred. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking now with Thomas Kane, chairman of the 9/11 Commission, a former Republican governor of the state of New Jersey. Governor Kane, there is a dispute between your staff members who had the interview with Colonel Schaefer and his recollection that the name Muhammad Atta was then mentioned. But I wanted to ask you about another aspect of this, the idea that this unit, Able Danger, wanted to pass this information along to the FBI and, according to Colonel Schaefer, was prevented from doing so.
If he's right, then that was obviously a great mistake. We don't know about that. There is none of that in the file. What happened when our staff found out about Able Danger, as we did with everything else, we requested every document having anything to do with Able Danger from the Pentagon and from the administration. The administration turned over a whole series of documents. They said everything having to do with Able Danger. We then made a second request, said, we haven't got anything now. Here's a second request. And is there anything else having to do with Able Danger?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we've given you everything. So we have we had every document having to do with Able Danger, unless the administration, for whatever reason, withheld information, which we hope they didn't.
And it should be pointed out the administration did turn over documents that did not make it look especially good.
Didn't that what?
The administration did turn over documents to you that did not make them look all that great.
Yes. Oh, yes. So, and this wasn't even them. This was the, I guess this goes back to the Clinton administration. So
sure.
Why the administration of the Pentagon would have withheld documents, I mean, it seems strange to me, but there's nothing in those documents. And we went over them again because census came out, we sent the staff in to look at the documents again, so to make sure there was nothing about Muhammad Atta, nothing about a Brooklyn cell, nothing about that, and there isn't. There's nothing in those documents. So all we can do on the commission is say these are the facts, and we didn't draw a lot of conclusions other than recommendations. We said these are the facts of what happened in 9/11. The facts in this case simply his recollection, I guess, of the meeting is different than the four other people who were there. And the four other people who were there don't remember the name of Muhammad Atta, don't remember the discussion the same way. It could be they're mistaken. But four of them, one from the White House and three from the staff, feel that way. And the documents that we've been able to get and review again, because we went back into the files to look at them, our staff did on last week, don't seem to bear out some of the things that have been said. But having said that, that's all we know. The commission itself got no information whatsoever beyond what was in the files.
Let me ask you, there was also a published report today about State Department documents referring to Osama bin Laden's move from Sudan to Afghanistan back in, I guess, July 1996, and a warning from a State Department analyst saying that bin Laden may be more dangerous in Afghanistan than he was even in Sudan. This was brought out by a lawsuit filed by Judicial Watch. We're going to have hear from them a little later in the program. Were you aware of that document?
I don't know if I was aware of that document. I was aware that a lot of people felt that way. I mean, this was not just whatever document came out here. There was, and I think we say that actually in the in the commission report itself, was a great mistake to allow bin Laden to leave and get to Afghanistan. And I think everybody's acknowledged that. There were people within the government and outside of government at the time who said this is a very dangerous guy, and we should get him now. So this is nothing new.
Is there any way, should Colonel Schaefer's charges turn out to have been accurate, there's no way at this point to resurrect the commission or conduct a further investigation?
We looked at 2,000 documents. We gave the American people every fact we had, and we've gone out of existence. We've got a small group we've maintained with private funds to try to pursue the recommendations the commission has made to make the American people safer. And that's what we're pursuing now. But the commission itself has been out of existence for a long time. I think if there's any documentation of any kind to support what Colonel Schaefer is saying, then I think another body, whether it's Congressman Weldon or a committee or whatever, should certainly look into it, because this would certainly be news to us, but a very important part of the puzzle. If in fact the Pentagon knew something about the movements of Muhammad Atta, tried to pass it on to other government agencies and was not allowed to, that would be a very important allegation, very important fact. And if there's anything to back it up, and anything that the Pentagon should be able to answer questions on it. I mean, we don't have that information. The Pentagon does. The administration does. And if there's any accuracy to them at all, we should be hearing from the administration and the Pentagon.
Governor Kaine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Tom Kaine is chairman of the 9/11 Commission, former governor of New Jersey. He joined us by phone from his office in Far Hills in New Jersey. We turn now to Harry Skip Brandon, former deputy assistant director in charge of counterterrorism and national security at the FBI. He's now with us from his offices at Smith Brandon International, a defense and security consulting firm here in Washington. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
Assuming that this strategic command group passed along its able danger information to the FBI, how much would that have helped?
Well, it's hard to say. We are in the twilight zone of hindsight, but
yeah.
It strikes me that probably had it been passed on, it would have fortified interest in Atta. There's no question about that in my mind, and who knows whether it would have led to the prevention or not, but it certainly would have should have keyed the FBI to push hard.
We always talk about connecting the dots. Again, if true, this seems like a pretty big dot.
Yeah, it does. I'm a little leery of connecting the dots. I've done this many times afterwards where you reassess where your investigation went, and there are always things you see that you wish you'd noted as you went. But having said that, this could be a big dot. There's no question about that.
Again, remind us, too, that this would have been one more additional piece, however important it might have been, but one more additional piece of information amidst a blizzard of information.
Yes, that's very, very true. Even at this stage, pre-9/11, there's no question that the various intelligence and law enforcement agencies of the government were keyed up. Everybody was expecting something. We've heard all of that. We've heard George Tenet say that. So it would have been one, but I just would have to say that I think that it would have been picked up and acted upon.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you again, and we're going on Colonel Schaefer's statements here, and I guess Congressman Weldon's too, but that this idea of military lawyers saying, well, wait a minute, we're not necessarily supposed to pass on intelligence gathered by military agencies about people who are in this country legally to the FBI.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that we're going by statements made by two people. None of us have all of the facts in front of us. Excuse me. Having said this, there was always a bit of tension between some of the agencies and I guess what I'd call the external agencies, the foreign intelligence collectors and the domestic intelligence collectors, with, I will say, various agencies that collected foreign intelligence being extraordinarily cautious about passing on information. It is possible that that's what we saw. It's unforgivable, but that may be what we saw.
Were there times when people bent the rules and tried to pass along information they regarded as urgent?
You always try to maintain good and close relationships with your counterparts in other agencies.
I'll take that as a yes.
Well, very often we found people who really were involved and interested found ways to, whether passing on the information or at least alerting an agency to the fact that there might be information and probably getting the agency to request any information, which kind of reversed the whole flow.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that. Is this concern, though, again, going back into this story, that these military lawyers were concerned about the idea of a military intelligence unit passing on information about people who are here legally, was that a legitimate concern?
Well, yes. It could have been a legitimate concern, but with the value of hindsight and seeing what it was, there was always the option for them to have huddled with the Department of Justice, who is pointed to as having issued these restrictions, and mm-hmm. saying, "We have something. Is this what you really mean?"
And are these the kinds of walls between to intelligence sharing that have been torn down since 9/11?
Yes. My impression is, and I'm on the outside now, but my impression is that most of those walls are gone. Those walls were there. They were not helpful. In fact, at times they were hurtful. And it was just a cross we had to bear, so to speak, at the time. They never should have been there, in my opinion.
Let me ask you also about the technique that was used, and again, Colonel Schaefer was circumspect. He said Able Danger apparently did a lot of stuff, but one of the things they did was so-called open-source data mining.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, that's simply a technique for going at information that is out there that essentially is publicly available, or at least available to on the Internet and various other resources, and just pulling bits and pieces together and putting them together and seeing if you can get a complete picture. This can be done rather laboriously by using analysts just to go through information, or there are computer programs available that try to make the links for you. It's basically using artificial intelligence to gather bits of information and put it together. It's very efficient.
Google on steroids, is that...
Yeah, that's a great phrase, but to a degree it is. But the programs that are used, and we don't know what was used, but I could only guess that might have been used by professionals would be probably much more sophisticated than that.
Mm-hmm. How would this relate to, a couple of years ago, retired Admiral John Poindexter was in charge of a program, I think, called Total Information Awareness that became quite controversial, in part because of John Poindexter's involvement with it. But would this have been along the same lines?
I think we could guess that it was something along those lines. Now, these programs are done, they're kept pretty quiet simply because, in a way, they're kind of alarming to civilians like I am now and all of us are. It's kind of horrifying in a way how much information is out there and available about each one of us. That's not to fault Admiral Poindexter or the military or anybody else. The information's out there. They were making use of it.
Yeah, we did a show with somebody who retrieves information like that and used me as an example. I had to shut him up.
I know. I've actually run myself a few times not using a sophisticated program. It's kind of scary.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of information out there.
Yeah.
We're talking with Skip Brandon, former Deputy Assistant Director in charge of counterterrorism and national security at the FBI. He retired in 1993 after 23 years with the FBI in various jobs. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As you look at this story in terms of a counterterrorism point of view, obviously, again, in hindsight, a lot of mistakes were made, but ferreting out this kind of information, this thread here, again, in a huge tapestry of information, this is extremely difficult work.
It's extraordinarily difficult. My business partner often likens what's available today as trying to find the right drop of water coming at you from a fire hose.
That's a pretty apt analogy. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, TOTN@npr.org, and we'll talk with Troy. Troy calling from Iowa City, in Iowa, of course.
Yes, I got a quick question. Has the lawyers that keep saying, hey, we couldn't tell anyone because there's a difference between military and the FBI, have they been placed under oath and asked, is this true, or is someone just making up this story saying, well, we think it's the lawyers that made this opinion up?
So far as I...
Anyone actually interviewed those lawyers that say it was, hey, we stopped them because of this?
Yeah. So far as I know, Troy, the lawyers have not been identified, nor have they been asked to do this.
Well, maybe NPR could find that out for us.
We'll do our very best, and I'm sure that the Pentagon will be certainly asked a lot of questions about this. And if you
and maybe the Senate and Congress could interview those lawyers and ask them the same question.
I thought you heard Chairman Kaine suggest that maybe Congressman Weldon would be interested in asking some of those questions.
And maybe the staff members who were at that meeting be polled between on the. Red carpet and ask them, well, did you record this interview and where are the tapes?
Mm-hmm. That's another good question. Thank you very much, Troy.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can get Tony on the line. Tony's calling from Bear Mountain in New York.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Very good. My question is real simple. Why not use, although I know it's illegal to use the NSA on U.S. citizens, but why not use what they have, their technology on maybe non-U.S. citizens within the United States? Have they thought of doing something along those lines for...
Skip Brandon, what as far as you understand it, are the regulations about using military or intelligence assets to spy on American citizens or those in the U.S. legally?
essentially, they are not to do intelligence collection on U.S. citizens in the United States or persons or people who are considered to be U.S. persons, which is basically is people who are here legally. Having said that, I'll be a little careful here. There are provisions for sharing of information that they acquire about U.S. persons while in the conduct of their foreign in collection, if they recognize that it is material and important, then there are special procedures which do allow them, after review, to share that information.
Won't that take a lot of time?
I'm sorry?
He asked, wouldn't that take a lot of time?
No, this this sounds rather laborious, maybe the way I explained it, but with something somebody that gets information they recognize, let's say, is hot information, sometimes it can be a matter of hours.
Tony,
thank you very much for your time and for taking my call.
Okay, Tony, thanks very much for getting through to us. And Skip Brandon, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Harry Brandon is former Deputy Assistant Director in charge of counterterrorism and national security at the FBI, also founding partner of Smith Brandon International, a defense and security consulting firm, and he joined us from his office here in Washington. When we come back from a short break, we'll find out about that other information about this time Osama bin Laden and his transfer from Sudan to Afghanistan, and about those computer worms. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News. As we discussed earlier, pre-9/11 intelligence regarding Osama bin Laden has also surfaced. The State Department warned the Clinton administration in 1996 that bin Laden's move from Sudan to Afghanistan would make him much more dangerous to the United States. The Conservative Foundation Judicial Watch obtained the declassified documents through a Freedom of Information Act request. And joining us now by phone from his office here in Washington is Tom Fitton, president of Judicial Watch. Nice to have you on the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
What do these documents tell us about bin Laden's capabilities and the move from Sudan to Afghanistan?
Well, they said that Afghanistan would actually be, these are State Department documents at the top secret level that were just unclassified last month. The document suggests that the move to Afghanistan would put him in an even more ideal location to operate against U.S. interests as long as he could continue to run his businesses and financial networks unmolested. And they point out his access there that he would have to the hundreds of Mujahideen that were being trained in terrorist operations. And in the end, it said, you know, we've got to be aware of this. Even a bin Laden on the move can retain the capability to support individuals and groups who have the motive and wherewithal to attack U.S. interests almost worldwide. So given that significant, I guess, threat analysis, it's fair to say, and in this document he's implicated or suspected in at least two terrorist incidents against U.S. interests, you know, one wonders if the administration could have done more to roll up this transnational network, to quote from the document, that bin Laden was able to take advantage of.
And this was at a time the United States government, the Clinton administration, was pressuring Sudan to basically kick bin Laden out.
That's right, and there were reports, and there are still some credible allegations that the bin Laden was offered to the administration by the Sudanese government, and the actual underlying Freedom of Information Act request that resulted in these documents was asking about that, and this is what was turned over. And the document was first, or documents generally were first requested back in December 2001.
As you say, there have been stories around that the Sudanese offered to turn bin Laden over to the United States. There's no proof of that, though.
There is no proof, and the documents don't address it one way or another. There's, it's possible, given the tenor of the Sudanese government's discussions with the U.S., they were desperate to kind of get out from under the gun in terms of terrorist support and financing, were desperate to work with the United States. The United States, understandably, was a little bit suspicious of the Sudanese government given its record. But that issue specifically, you can't find one way or another whether it happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, the New York Times reported today that these documents show the Clinton administration was watching bin Laden closely back before his move to Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean they were concerned that that he was had the safe haven in the Sudan and presumably had been pressuring the Sudanese government to go after bin Laden and other terrorist movements that had safe haven there. But he went to Afghanistan and the administration knew in 96 that it would be more trouble and even not in the sense of more trouble, but he would be more troublesome in Afghanistan. Because of the terrorist networks in place there.
Mm-hmm. Your group, Judicial Watch, is probably best known for taking on the Clinton administration back when it was in office. And I wonder, is this part of, was this suit part of an agenda?
Well, the agenda is to get the truth out. And Judicial Watch has a history of asking both Republican and Democratic administrations uncomfortable questions about issues that they don't want to talk about. We famously went to Dick Cheney, went to the Supreme Court against Dick Cheney for his Energy Task Force records. And the New York Times reported on documents that the Bush administration released to us showing the Bush administration may have given favorable treatment to Saudi nationals in the days after 9/11. You know, so we call them as we see them. And, you know, the agenda here is, you know, why wasn't the government more active in defending the U.S. against this threat as indicated, as described in this 1996 document?
Tom Fitton, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Tom Fitton, president of Judicial Watch, joined us by phone from his office in Washington. When we come back, computer worms.